Next weekend, Kansas City will be home to an event called Maker Fair. But what, you may ask, is a maker? Makers are, quite simply, people who make things. An artist who makes clothes, a musician who makes albums, a culinary wizard canning jam, or a programmer making robots. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we'll talk with a couple of local characters about why they make what they make, from the trash boat regatta to an up-and-coming craft brewery. Plus, we'll revisit the world of weather balloon enthusiasts.
Okay, here we go.
Hit it.
Down. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Go, go, go.
Meet your local makers on Central Standard, right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'm starting my week feeling the love for people who make things. On the practical end of the spectrum, you've got your Home Depot heroes building decks in their backyards. At the other end, things get a whole lot quirkier than that. With the Maker Fair coming up, we're talking with a couple of creative innovators to learn about Kansas City's maker scene and how it fits into national trends. You may have heard of the DIY punk scene and craftivism a few years back. Later in the show, we'll find out whether the maker movement is a continuation of that whole idea or a departure from it. For now, let's start with Michelle Davis. Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
Let's get right into this. You make boats out of trash and you encourage others to do the same.
Oh, absolutely.
How did you get into this? Explain it. Tell us the story.
We're calling this our sixth annual regatta, but I looked back at my website and we've actually been doing this for 5 years. We just did it twice 1 year. So anyways, the genesis of it was about 5 years ago. I was unemployed, bored, and on the internet, seeing some other people had made boats out of stuff and had some pretty wild boating parties. So Chunk 666 up in Portland and the Rat Patrol in Chicago particularly had, you know, some fine adventures they put up online.
Michelle, could I say something really quickly? I just want to make sure that our listeners understand some of what they're hearing right now. You have brought someone with you today. We're going to get back to your story, but
is he making noise?
Just a little bit. We'll just introduce him so that our listeners aren't confused.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I brought my son with me, Joseph. He's just under a year old.
And he is adorable.
Had minor child care snafus.
No trouble. Just feel free to carry on with your story.
I'd been on the internet seeing other people do dumb stuff, and I'm like, heck, dumb stuff. This is awesome. And floated the idea past my husband and a couple of our friends who happened to be over that evening, and they're like, yeah, we ought to do it.
Explain what a trash boat is. I mean, it is what it sounds like.
It's any homemade boat made out of, you know, stuff that's been pulled out of the recycling. We principally make rafts with pontoons made out of soda bottles, but you can float anything. I've seen people use kitty litter buckets, the big 55-gallon food-grade drums. I mean, literally anything that can float. One of our teams a few years ago used basically the guts of an old hot tub, all of the foam insulation, so...
So you mentioned a team. So that has to do with the regatta itself, the trash boat regatta. Explain
right.
What that is.
So you make a boat. We get together. Usually it's either the weekend before or the weekend after Independence Day. And we go out on the river, and theoretically it's a race. But realistically, it's basically a boating party.
How many people are we talking about?
We've had... The most boats we've had on the water, I think, was 6, but there were multiple people on several of those boats. The biggest boat, the one that was made with the old hot tub, I think had 8 people on it, 6 or 8 people.
On your website, there's a list of instructions, mm-hmm. sort of, to get people started if they want to build a trash boat. And I'm kind of fascinated by the instructions because the building part is just 2 steps. Start building a boat and keep building a boat. How do you build a boat?
The one that I've used over and over and over again was my husband's design. It's basically a very lightweight wooden frame about 2.5 feet wide by about 7.5, 8 feet long. And on the underside of that, you take what I've been doing. You take laundry detergent jugs are the gold standard because they're very tough. They seal well, and you can run your bungee cord through the handle. But soda bottles will work too. 2-liter bottles, bundle them together in groups of four with duct tape, and then lash those down to the frame with, we've been using old bicycle inner tubes as the bungee cord.
And then one thing I want to draw out is you mentioned duct tape, and it sounds like this issue of being sure to use new duct tape is important.
Yeah, you have to use fresh duct tape year after year. I've been using the same bottles for about 4 years, but I just, you know, budget $12 worth of dollar store duct tape, which is about 6 rolls, and just strap them up again each time around.
Are there requirements for people to be included in the Trash Boat Regatta? What makes the sort of percentage of items that are recycled sufficient to qualify?
Oh, there's no hard and fast rule. We've got, you're not allowed to spend over $100, but you would be hard-pressed to spend $100 to build a boat. We have 3 rules, essentially. One is you can't spend over $100, although obviously I'm not going to be asking for receipts because that'd be administration. The other 2 rules are more safety orientated. The one is everybody has to have a life vest. You've got to have personal flotation device. That is not negotiable. And the other is no drinking until we pull out down at the end. You know, I don't want people getting drunk before. And it'd be ideal if they weren't getting drunk while they were out on the water, because the landing can be a little tricky if you're not accustomed to it. So, you know, that's common sense.
How much time would you say you spend on an average spring or summer day devoted to building trash boats?
Well, you know, if you're not real ambitious, you can build a boat in basically a Saturday. If you are very ambitious, you can take months. You know, you can build a little miniature Viking ship, or I heard tell of some guy who'd built like a replica of the Titanic that was like, you know, 1/100th scale. It was basically a canoe. They didn't make it to the regatta, but it's one of the guys who does art cars over in Lawrence. So you can get as intricate or as primitive as you like.
What in your mind makes a really great boat? Do you try to make the boats pretty or in some way aesthetically pleasing, or is it all about function?
That depends on your personal bent. I am hoping in the future to make something that just looks completely mad, but my boats thus far have just been pure function. We have Jacqueline Dalby, who's been helping with promotion a lot for the event this year, and last year, actually. Last year, her team's boat was so cool. It had this sort of articulated tail. It was essentially a ride-on sea serpent, and it was just the coolest thing.
What do you feel like you personally get out of doing this? Like, what does the process contribute to your life or your experience?
Oh, golly. I'd never thought of that. I just, you know, when we came up with the whole notion, it was kind of a free, fun event. You know, too much fun is commodified. People, you know, pay to go out and go to happy hour and pay to go to this concert and that, you know, a theme park. And it's like, why not do something for free that's just, you know, it's just an excuse to goof off, honestly.
Well, and you're going to participate in the Maker Faire coming up next weekend. Can you explain for our listeners who may be unfamiliar what your interpretation of what the Maker's Faire is?
Well, I understand it's a lot of people who are kind of creative craftspeople. I know there are a lot of the participants are more geared toward getting actual functional inventions out into the world. You know, there, I have a feeling we're going to be kind of like, you know, the bad news bears rocking up with our rubbish rafts, but I imagine there's room for dirt bags too.
Well, what is your sense of what it means to be a maker? Is it valuable to connect with other people who make things, even if their projects couldn't be more different from yours?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, just the fact that there are people doing something rather than sitting around on their butt and watching TV or whatever, you know, it's just the energy of people being creative is, it's fun. It's neat to see other people making stuff. It's inspiring to see people who can actually make something functional and beautiful.
Some might argue that putting a boat on water that does not cause you to then sink into the water off of the boat is functional, but I will take what you said in the spirit it was intended, and I'd like to turn now to another maker here in the studio who is also participating in next weekend's Maker Faire. Good morning, Rafi Chowdhury.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. You're one of a handful of people starting a craft brewery here in town. It's called Torn Label. Tell us about it.
Yeah, Torn Label Brewing Company. We are opening the Crossroads, and we hope to be open by the end of the year. And we'll be at Maker Faire as well. We have a 15-barrel brewing system. Myself and the four founders all grew up in Kansas City, and we're all actually living elsewhere when we kind of had the chance to start this operation. But, you know, Kansas City is where we started discovering good beer. We started kind of cut our teeth drinking better beer, so it was just it wouldn't have been anywhere near as meaningful for us to open up this, to start this endeavor anywhere but Kansas City. And we've been thrilled to see what the craft beer scene had, the way it's exploded in the recent few years here in town. And we're really happy to be a part of that.
How did you personally originally get involved in brewing beer? Has it always been a possible career path for you, or was it at one time a hobby?
It was very much just a hobby and a passion for a long time, and it actually came about through my the other project that I'll be at Maker Faire with, which is an independent film. But I was producing a film in Paris and living there for about the course of a year. And, you know, obviously Paris is wine country, and I enjoy wine, so I was mostly indulging in the good wine out there. But, you know,
good
I did
you.
Enjoy good beer. So every now and then I wanted to have a good beer. And when you drank good beer in Paris, at that time especially, you drank Belgian beer. And I started going to some Trappist cafes in Paris and discovering the Belgian ales, the brewing monks and the Abbey ales, things like that, which really opened up an entirely new world of flavor and opened my palate to a lot of different flavor combinations and ingredients and kind of the possibilities of what beer could be. And of course, you know, close enough to be able to make trips to Belgium by train and visits to the monasteries where they're brewing beer out there and seeing all that firsthand. And that kind of started me on a path. When I got back to the States, I saw where the craft beer, American craft beer movement was and was thrilled with what that had to offer.
Well, you mentioned going to Belgian monasteries. And when I think of current innovations in craft brewing, I think of something sort of technologically advanced. And I think of the monastery as representing this very old world. Do you see a connection between what you witnessed at the monastery and what you're going to be doing here in Kansas City?
Yeah, you know, I don't really see craft beer, even in the States, as particularly technologically advanced, really. I think in its very basic sense, beer is a very simple process, you know, whether it's a massive industrial operation or a craft American operation or a traditional Belgian brewery. There are some really, really traditional ones, though, in around Brussels, around the Seine Valley in particular, which, you know, have been using the same methods for centuries. And, you know, that's certainly a different level of where you're starting from than some of the American operations. But, you know, I think American and Belgian styles and approaches are actually more similar than dissimilar. Both of them have this kind of unencumbered sense of freedom. They are less constrained by style restrictions, and they're really kind of willing to kind of push the boundaries and explore, you know, what, you know, it's all about kind of finding the new ingredient or the new kind of hybrid of styles.
What do you like about brewing beer?
You know, from our origins, and I think that's kind of why we're at Maker Faire, especially, and why we're excited to be a part of it. You know, we're thrilled to be working on a professional brewing system, but our origins are very much in the home brewing movement, like a lot of, if not most, of craft brewery owners and brewmasters. And, you know, especially our brewmaster, Travis, he was a phenom and just brewing phenomenally creative and challenging, exciting beer before he was legally able to drink it. And, you know, our name actually is a reference to that as well. You know, when you're bottling beer, typically, you know, you wash and sanitize a bottle and, you know, you reuse it. And typically, you know, home brewers will kind of try to cleanly peel off the label of whatever it was used before. Travis always just would tear off a little corner because he never saw the need to pull off to cleanly, you know, pull off the entire label. So, you know, we wanted to keep that reference to that the maker, the home brewing kind of roots of our operation, Torn Label Brewing, and just to keep, you know, no matter what size we are, starting a pro system and eventually growing, we always want to keep that mentality of experimentation and of kind of creative expression, no matter where we are in the process.
Will you actually have those pieces of old labels on the bottles when your product goes commercial?
No, we'll have actual new labels on there, but, you know, people can feel free to leave them on or to tear off a quarter in homage to that.
What is your sense of what it means to be a maker more broadly?
In broad terms, you know, I think that being a maker is about kind of a self-expression, and you know, whatever you do, there, you know, there's a sense of accomplishment and of fulfillment in doing something yourself. You know, and what I love about the movement and about Maker Faire in particular is there's such a broad sense. You know, I think a maker can be in so many different, there's so many different entry levels, skill levels, and different types of, you know, endeavors, you know, from crafts to artistic endeavors to brewing to you know, mechanics, whatever. And I felt like it's always been a very expansive possibility of what you can do and still be a maker.
How big could your brewery get? How many employees could you hire or locations could you open and still think of yourself as a maker? Is there a point where the connection between you as an individual and the thing you make becomes too abstract to kind of, I guess, qualify, as it were?
You know, I don't think you can really put a number on it. I've seen a lot of great operations, breweries that have been very large size, you know, very large size craft breweries, and have really retained a sense of that kind of independent spirit and of kind of somewhat indulgent expression, without, you know, while still being, you know, very large and growing and expanding. You know, obviously, once you get to a certain point and you're adding, you know, dozens or hundreds of employees, every single person can't be involved in the process of, you know, brewing the beer or crafting the recipes. That's just, you know, just wouldn't be possible. At the same time, at a certain when you get to a certain point, I think it becomes about the culture and about, you know, kind of fostering that spirit of a sense of involvement and a sense of, you know, where you're kind of you feel like the beer and the product is something that's connected to you, even though, you know, you might be in a different area. And there's lots of ways to do that.
Rafi Chowdhury, you're also a filmmaker, and I want to talk to you about the documentary you worked on, Print the Legend. It isn't out yet, but it's gotten some early attention, and it's about 3D printers. Tell us about the film, because the 3D printer is also an interesting wrinkle in this making endeavor.
Right. So Print the Legend is about the cutthroat competition and the eccentric personalities, really, around the emerging world of 3D printing. We will be screening a teaser, kind of an extended teaser trailer at Maker Faire. And, you know, we're independent filmmakers, so we feel like that itself is also related to the maker movement. But, you know, it's also fun to be there with a doc that's specifically about 3D printing, because that certainly is something that's really captured the imagination of a lot of people in the maker movement for a lot of different reasons. You know, and I was just really happy to, you know, the film and the brewery, they're not affiliated in any way. There's no official connection, but I was one of the producers on Print the Legend, and another producer, the main producer, Chad Trotwine, is along with me, one of the four founders of Torn Label Brewing Company. So we just thought it'd be fun to be there with the two projects and to kind of really show how diverse the spectrum of what it means to be a maker can be.
Quick thought about 3D printers before we move on to actually another guest, but I wonder, to what extent do you think something made with a 3D printer can be considered handmade or crafted?
You know, there's so many different levels. At the end of the day, it's a tool, you know, so it's really in kind of how you use it. You know, the same way, there's so many parallels to, you know, when computers went from, you know, industrial to personal. You know, you can use a computer right now. You're not necessarily a maker if you have a computer, but you can use it to publish, to create music, you know, to create artwork. And 3D printing is very much in that same vein, I think. You know, you can, you know, on one level, you know, you can just kind of download the digital files and print the solid object yourself. And, you know, that's still something of being a maker. That's still kind of, you know, that's you're much more connected to the process and the product than you would be if you were just buying something newly made off the shelf that was made in China. On the other hand, you can, you know, you can download the file and tinker with it and personalize it, make it better, do whatever you want with it, or you can create the file from new. So you have so many different points to it. And again, I think that the maker movement, you know, do it yourself doesn't necessarily have to mean do everything yourself. You know, you could be just kind of adjusting and kind of playing with tinkering someone else's design, or you could be making something completely new.
Well, hold that thought, because we have another guest with us. But for those who have just tuned in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman. We've been talking with Michelle Davis, who makes boats out of trash, and Rafi Chowdhury, who has a commercial enterprise turning his home brewing hobby into a craft brewing business. Now we're talking with Garth Johnson. In addition to having participated in Maker Faires himself, Garth is something of an expert on the overall movement. He's written books on creative reuse, and his TED Talk, provocatively called Recycling Sucks, has been popular, to say the least. Garth, what do you think Michelle and Rafi have in common?
Well, I think the fact that they consider themselves makers and don't necessarily see hard boundaries between what they do and what other creative people do is totally something that signifies the maker movement as a movement.
So what do you think about the crafting and DIY movements, that is do-it-yourself, and these activities that are in the maker movement? Do you think that those movements that were gaining momentum in the last couple of decades have a relationship with the maker movement you see today?
Well, I think absolutely. I think calling something the maker movement is just putting the broadest possible umbrella over a lot of different activities that people do. I'm someone who, in addition to kind of having roots in DIY punk and traveling around with bands and owning a record store, I actually have a degree from art school in ceramics and got a master's degree in ceramics. And there are a lot of people within the art world or the sort of quote unquote craft world that see sort of hard boundaries between what they do and what other creative types do. And I guess I've tried to spend my career bridging those boundaries or trying to tear those boundaries down.
I'd like to think about maybe the potter's wheel, that could be a technology that at one point people said, you're not really making that pot by hand, you use the wheel.
Absolutely. The pottery wheel was a very disruptive technology when it came out originally, to kind of use Silicon Valley terms. So anytime new technology comes down the pike, a 3D printer, whatever, there will always be people challenging the validity of that particular tool as a making tool.
You mentioned that there are some people who try to draw hard and fast lines. Where are those lines that people are trying to draw? What would you say some of the sources of debate and discussion are?
Well, I guess having been in academia and being kind of an academically trained maker, I'm constantly going to conferences about craft where a bunch of egg-headed people get into a room and try to talk about what craft is and where craft is headed. And there are always people who, you know, sort of slam their shoe on the table and say that we can't move forward as a field unless we know exactly and pin down exactly what the word craft means. But I think that's sort of toothpaste that can't be put back in the tube in a way.
Explain what you mean by that.
So English is a language that is constantly living and evolving and is kind of murky in a lot of ways. And I guess anyone who is in academia is striving for clarity. But I represent a segment of makers and academics who prize a little bit of art damage and crazy activity over, I guess, the easy categories that you could put things into.
Well, speaking of not putting things into easy categories, could you tell us a little bit about your background and some of the movements? You mentioned that you come from a music and maybe fine art background, but could you unpack that a little bit? Tell us about your path.
Sure. I guess, you know, I like to think about craft generationally, and every generation tends to have a boom in sort of making and craft and DIY. My father was born in the 1930s and got to totally participate as a kid in popular mechanics and building crystal sets and doing things like that. As my parents were adults, they participated in the 1960s and 70s craft boom. I think as a family, we participated in just about every type of sort of hip craft that there was to try out. Wood burning and macrame. I can remember making macrame as a family. And then on into the like 80s and 90s, I grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and joined bands and was part of the Nebraska music scene that kind of later exploded. I owned a record store. I started a record label. I was in a band that toured. And then it's interesting to have seen in the early 1990s, the Riot Girl and sort of DIY punk movement burgeon.
Explain what that is.
Yeah, sure. You know, I think there was an ethos starting with punk rock in the 1980s where bands, starting with bands like the Minutemen, And Black Flag, they rejected the idea of sort of striving to be on a nationally owned major record label and instead kind of put out their own records, put together their own tours, carried their own gear, made their own T-shirts, and kind of controlled all of the facets of their lives as bands. They also formed their own networks pre-internet. It's funny, I also participated in zines, like small-scale magazines that you used to have to send self-addressed stamped envelopes away to other people to get. And those were all ways before the internet that musicians and makers of different types connected each other. You have parallel scenes in sort of shortwave radio and lots of individual communities where people prized connecting themselves with each other. And then it's interesting that I really think that a lot of the people involved in DIY, do-it-yourself music in the 1980s and 90s later sort of impacted the do-it-yourself craft movement, which then sort of empowered the maker movement. So all of these things sort of feed into each other. And one of the things that we see is sort of an explosion of energy and people doing things. And then a few years down the road, those people start to organize things and start organizations and kind of multiply their power and starting things like Make Magazine and Maker Faire. And all of these Maker Faire and Make Magazines do sort of have, business, corporate roots in different ways, but they've spun out in all sorts of different directions to empower people.
What do you think about this whole Maker Faire phenomenon? It's a national series of events that go from city to city, but really trying to tap into the local communities of makers. And Maker, as you've just explained, encompasses what used to be separate little niche movements, but now you've got the crafters and the musicians and the rebellious technologists all under one umbrella.
I think it all feeds into, every other scene, and everyone is sort of amplifying the making of everybody else. I think Maker Faire was something that was very appealing to me from the get-go. I think it started in 2006 in the Bay Area, and it took off really quickly. Within 3 or 4 years, they were getting 80,000 people into this fairgrounds in San Mateo, which is just south of San Francisco. And it wasn't long before sort of satellite Maker Faires started. Detroit has a really interesting Maker Faire that totally taps into its history as a maker culture in terms of automobiles and has a large population of people who are very gifted at making things.
Well, Garth, I'm going to have to interrupt you for just a second. We're going to go to a break, and then we'll be back talking to Garth Johnson, Michelle Davis, and Rafi Chowdhury about making things, and in particular about the Maker Faire next weekend in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on the show we are talking about people who make things in Kansas City, and we're sharing some love for them and what they do and finding out some nuance about what it means to be a maker. We're speaking with Garth Johnson, who runs the website Extreme Craft, and Michelle Davis, who makes trash boats and is here with her young son, Joseph. You might be hearing him there. And Rafi Chowdhury from Torn Label Brewing Company. He was also on the production team for Print the Legend about 3D printers. So we're getting every perspective that we can think of on what it means to be a maker. And Garth Johnson, you were talking about Detroit's Maker Faire when we went to break. Could you talk a little bit about Kansas City's? I know you have a relationship with Kansas City.
Sure, absolutely. I grew up in Nebraska. Kansas City was one of the, accessible cities that I traveled to a lot. I actually married a Kansas City Art Institute grad. But Kansas City has a creative culture that is very vast. I think arguably the city maybe hasn't always grasped the power of its artist community and its maker community, but it certainly does now. And it uses artists, I think, very effectively as ways to sort of build neighborhoods and build community, providing spaces, providing funding, providing energy. And Kansas City is actually, I think, a great model for other cities when it comes to, in a lot of ways, ways to handle its arts community.
And Garth, what do you think is the value of an event like Maker Faire? Is it important on some really crucial level for people who do this to come together and share what they do in one space over a weekend?
I think absolutely. But one of the things that I really want to stress as someone who goes kind of way back with Maker Faire is the educational potential of the maker movement. All of the times that I've visited Maker Faire, I've had a particular eye to how Maker Faire interacts with students and younger people. And I can say that the Maker Faire is sort of an umbrella movement that covers technology and crafting and art in different ways. I think there's always been an eye in the maker movement toward making up for some of the deficiencies of ways that children are educated, and to empower children toward using making as a tool for learning. So the STEM movement, science, technology, engineering, and math, grasped that from the very beginning and is trying to do sort of practical hands-on things to get students to grasp sort of new things about engineering and math, and to create a new generation of engineers and mathematicians. And all of that is something that you can see on display, as well as inserting the A for art into STEM, which has become STEAM in the last couple of years.
Well, we're going to get back to that idea of STEM, but I want to talk to our in-studio guests a little bit, and I also want to reach out to our listeners, makers of all kinds. We want to hear from you. Some people make things hoping others will find those things useful, but we want to know what you get out of making things. What you get out of the sheer act of creating something as opposed to the thing itself. Call us at 816-235-2888 to tell us what you make and, most importantly, why. That number again is 816-235-2888. Michelle Davis, when you listen to this conversation, I wonder if you have thoughts about what you and Rafi Chowdhury, a brewer, have in common. What does the trash boat have in common with the home-brewed beer?
Well, I'm actually a home brewer myself. There's a big overlap in the kind of cycling and brewing communities. And
you're in the cycling community as well.
I suppose. Yeah, I ride my bike pretty much everywhere. But anyways, how a brewer and a boat maker might have something in common. Well, I mean, when it comes down to it, there is kind of this satisfaction of making something yourself to your own specifications, you know, and one of the things, as Rafi was saying about brewing, it's in and of itself a fairly simple process, but then you can play around with the details to get exactly what you want out of what you're making. And, you know, the boats are the same. Your basic process is very simple. You just need enough buoyancy and enough stick it together. Whoa, excuse me.
Rafi, I wonder, one of the things Michelle mentioned earlier in the show was that part of what she's doing when she makes trash boats is a form of entertainment that is maybe not passive, not just receiving. And I wonder if home brewing started that way for you.
You know, I think it does for a lot of people. You know, you see, most often, I think the entry point into home brewing is just enjoying craft beer. You know, as people become more interested in local products, the next step is, you know, going as local as you can possibly be and making it yourself. You know, and that's, you know, it's rewarding to find something that's close to you, that's made in your own hometown, and even more rewarding, of course, to make it yourself. And just to add to what Michelle was saying, I think another thing that, you know, is somewhat oddly makes these kind of feels related is just finding creative solutions as you kind of work through problems. I think for a lot of makers, you know, that's really one of the great joys of the process, is because it never goes exactly according to plan, you know. So, but you know, those frustrations, and I think the kind of limitations and constraints, and the fulfillment you get when you find ways through the roadblocks, are something that's kind of common to a lot of different maker movements. You know, whether it's a, you know, stuck fermentation, or, you know, even on a film when you're not getting access that you want, on a trash boat that, you know, is not buoyant the way that you want it to be. You know, the taking the steps that you need to make it workable and to get to the next phase, despite the kind of obstacles, is just one of the best parts about making something, I think.
Can you tell us a story about when you experienced this frustration and then resulting payoff when you solved the problem?
I can actually talk a lot about the Print the Legend. Actually started off as a very...
And that's the documentary.
That's the documentary, yeah. Sorry to jump around a little bit. But that actually started off as a very different film than we ended up with. That film was initially developed as a documentary about the rise of Apple computers and about Steve Jobs. And we kind of approached it that way for quite a while. And, we ultimately... we always wanted in that film to have kind of a counterpart of a kind of young... up-and-coming, the potential future Steve Jobs operation, you know? So we wanted to focus on another kind of entrepreneur in that vein.
So you were looking for, like, Apple Part 2.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, as we went further, we found, you know, we just weren't getting the kind of level of access to Apple that we wanted. That's, you know, part of what we thought was fascinating about the story. There's such great secrecy there. But, you know, if we were to tell that story in the documentary, it would have been a much... more kind of an archival film, kind of retelling the story through archive footage, that sort of thing, which would have been interesting. But, you know, what we found with the figures in the 3D printing world that we ultimately focus on was, in a lot of ways, telling that story of Apple, the potential new world of, you know, personal 3D printing as it happens. You know, so instead of looking back and telling a story that has already transpired, we were able to kind of pivot and shift course and to tell a story that is happening in real time.
Let's hear from one of our callers. We've got Jonathan in Kansas City. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Great.
Great. My name is Jonathan. I'm the founder of a technology company here in town called Big Bang, and we're actually bringing something to Maker Faire. We're working in partnership with Mozilla, and it's a project called the Gigabots, and it's actually bringing internet-connected robotics to K-12 classrooms. It's using the robotics platform that these kids already use. So there's something like 12,000 students in the Kansas City area that participate in robotics programs in their schools. And this product is basically letting them create robots that are connected to the internet. It gives them an opportunity to get these sort of connected devices in their hands and... we're going to be at the Maker Faire.
That's great.
And we're going to be there with Mozilla, and I think
Hey, Jonathan, I'm going to let our guest Garth Johnson talk about this a little bit, because Garth, you were mentioning that there is an educational component to Maker Faire, and I'd like you to maybe talk about what Jonathan was just saying and how that plays into the importance of this event.
Sure, absolutely. I think that. Demonstrations and bringing things like robotics into classrooms are tangible ways to kind of immediately make students see the explosiveness and the power of the long road that they sometimes have to take to learn programming. And the maker movement seems to embrace a great step-by-step model that lets students kind of very quickly see results as they kind of learn more and more, ushering them into, you know, sort of much deeper knowledges of the technologies that they're learning.
And Jonathan has a business, and I wonder if you can also illuminate this issue of craft versus business, or the relationship between craft and business.
Well, I think it's interesting, and it's been sort of controversial sometimes, but there are a lot of businesses, and even the U.S. government in a lot of ways is taking a very long view. If we are going to kind of advance as a society and have more engineers and programmers down the road, then we need to do things to start building, those future programmers and engineers now. There's something that actually happened that was kind of controversial within the maker movement, and that is the Department of Defense, DARPA, who originally created the internet, created a large grant for Dale Doherty, who was the person who created the Maker Faire. He was one of the founders of Maker Faire, and DARPA is actually giving funding to create makerspaces that are going into schools. And this is something that maybe isn't going to pay off tomorrow for the business community, but the Defense Department, and you can see this however you want, either sinister or not, needs to have mathematicians and engineers and scientists down the road. So they're starting with elementary schools and middle schools today.
This is so funny, probably, to a lot of people, because there's this sort of popular notion of the artist as someone who is pursuing something that's maybe on the other end of the spectrum from something scientific and mathy and Department of Defense useful. And I'm wondering if the maker movement is possibly going to change that perception. Do you think that that's a real possibility?
I think it's absolutely a real possibility, but there's a real fluidity between those things. I think that anyone who is an artist, you know, already sort of knows from their friends and their community that that art is a huge spectrum, and there certainly has to be a place for artists who are interested in math and in systems and in programming, and that. And not to disparage underwater basket weaving, which is a real thing.
that is a real craft that people participate in?
That is a real craft, and it can be really amazing. But, you know, not everyone is sort of a crunchy granola potter or underwater basket weaver.
Right. And I wonder if Rafi Chowdhury could chime in on this, the relationship between the sort of art of brewing and the science of brewing.
Right. I mean, you know, at the core level, brewing is chemistry. You know, it's bit of the fermentation process is just, you know, a question of, you know, enzymes and yeast converting, you know, the wort into beer and into alcohol. You know, obviously the actual joy of it, you know, the actual joy of it from both the making process and the enjoying process is, you know, much more than that. And the same with it cooking, you know, it's you have a sort of blank canvas, and then, you know, from that palette you are able to kind of to weave in the sort of experience that that makes it so enjoyable, you know. So you can have the kind of dull paint by numbers, and obviously that's a big part of the brewing process, is getting the science exactly right. At the same time, you know, the expressionistic side of it is what makes it, you know, worthwhile, you know. So those things are both very much necessary. They tie in together at every step of the process. But, you know, for me, the actual finding the way that flavors work together, contrast, complement, that's the real, you know, fun of it.
When does your brewery open?
We're looking to open by the end of this year.
What's one of your favorite beers that you've made and that you're looking forward to sharing with the public?
You know, the one that one of our flagship beers is it's a Belgian-American table beer with local Missouri honey. And I think that's kind of emblematic of what we want Turn Label to be, in that, you know, it is a, you know, ostensibly an old world style. It's a Belgian single or a Belgian table beer. But, you know, traditionally a Belgian Abbey Ale would be use something like Belgian candy sugar to add a little bit of sweetness and to bump up alcohol content. To put our kind of unique spin on it, we use honey from Peculiar, Missouri, which, you know, again, we always want to put our own spin on something rather than just replicate an old world style.
Well, that's all the time that we have for this conversation with Michelle Davis of the Trash Boat Regatta, Rafi Chowdhury of Torn Label Brewing Company, and Garth Johnson, author of 1,000 Ideas for Creative Reuse. And also he maintains a website, Extreme Craft. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us on.
Michelle and Rafi will be participating in next weekend's Maker Fair. We'll have information about that event online at kcur.org later in the day. 2 weeks ago on this show, we talked to someone who would fit right in with the Maker Fair crowd. Photographer John Flagg sends cameras to the edge of space inside a weather balloon. When we met with him, he was on his way to the Great Plains Super Launch in Hutchinson. That's a gathering for people who send balloons equipped with tracking devices to the edge of our atmosphere. And then when the balloons burst, they parachute back to Earth. The balloon enthusiasts use tracking devices to find them. Okay, this all sounds very technical and perhaps even a bit nerdy, but our intern Christina Leffring was intrigued by the whole thing and went out to Hutchinson to witness the launch firsthand. She found a whole community built around space exploration, amateur radio, and the adventurous spirit of a treasure hunt.
For Bill Brown, it all started after he saw a documentary about a man who parachuted to the Earth from 100,000 feet above ground.
The description he gave of being able to see hundreds of miles in all direction and see the blackness of space and the curve of the Earth, I wanted to see that for myself. Some people strapped a bunch of balloons onto a lawn chair, but that seemed a little risky. So I decided to come up with a camera and a video camera to put up in a small weather balloon.
That was 30 years ago, and he's been launching balloons ever since. Brown is the father of high-altitude ballooning and a founding member of the annual Great Plains Super Launch. This year, despite concern over 30-mile-per-hour winds and a nearby tree line, founding member Paul Verhaeg is prepping his balloon and payload.
So a GPS receiver and a radio transmitter that'll transmit its location. My second balloon will actually send up science instruments.
So you're launching two balloons?
I'm doing two, that's right, yeah. Last year I did four, so I'm kind of weaseling out this year.
We clear everything.
Right. Okay, here we go.
Hit it.
Okay, are you up and transmitting?
Yeah, great.
Okay, we're good. Okay, now.
Okay, ready to let go. Okay, so don't hold on to the chute.
Watch your head. It's getting crazy.
Okay, just release. Let's go.
Count it down.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Go, go, go.
Cleared the trees.
Whoa. Keep going.
Now that the balloons are in the air, it's time to hunt them down. Marty Griffin and Mike Morgan are from Edge of Space Sciences, a volunteer group based in Denver that organizes launches with kids from age 4 all the way to college students. They agreed to let me tag along as they chase their balloons using GPS and ham radios.
The balloon will actually send down tracking information that gets received by the computers, and we'll actually watch it move across the map.
Griffin and Morgan lead a team of 8 trackers who communicate by ham radios and use code names like Alpha, Charlie, and Foxtrot.
Our role is we're kind of the coordinators of tracking our balloons, so all the other trackers report into us.
We have flown 195 flights and never lost a balloon. It is because we got really smart, dedicated trackers out here. The technology today is pretty good, but 23 years ago we were flying by the seat of our pants.
It's a lot more fun because with GPS technology, the chances of actually watching it land have gone way up. Being able to see it land is also a huge thrill for students.
Oh, yes.
You got to see those kids running into the fields. They're just jumping up and down. See high school kids, and they're kind of pretty cool. You get them out in the middle of nowhere tracking a balloon, and they're just like, 6-7-year-olds running around.
We pass through towns that are little more than a street with a stop sign, with names like Hope and Lost Springs. We drive on 2-lane roads that change to gravel, then to dirt, with names like Oat, Nail, or Half Mile Road.
South. What are we going on this road for?
I don't know.
Some local amateur radio operators ask what we're up to and help the team out. Griffin says this is typical.
Part of the amateur radio side of the hobby is that we all kind of help each other. We're good colleagues, even though the only time we ever talk, or maybe today, it's all a community.
No more of that frivolity.
At 90,000 feet, the balloon bursts. We continue to race down country roads and calculate the balloon's route as it parachutes to Earth.
Where to, boss?
Oh, I don't know.
Are we going to sit here for a minute?
Is it this one?
I don't know.
I have a degree in this.
We finally spot the balloon coming down into a field. The farmer gives us permission to go on his land, and the closest tracker goes to collect it.
Tally-ho!
Roger on the tally-ho. How cool is that? Tally-ho means that we actually have a tracker who has touched the payload.
Marty Griffin and Mike Morgan check in with the other teams to see if anyone needs help. But everyone's found their balloons and are wrapping things up. They all decide to meet at a local diner to swap stories.
Hey, this worked out pretty good today, buddy.
Yeah, it did.
Thank you very much.
For Central Standard, I'm Christina Leffring. That was intern Christina Leffring, who works on Central Standard every week here at KCUR. And tally-ho, as the
balloon enthusiasts would say. That's it for Central Standard this morning. We talked today to Michelle Davis of the Trash Boat Regatta, Rafi Chowdhury of Torn Label Brewing Company, and Garth Johnson, author of 1,000 Ideas for Creative Reuse. Michelle and Rafi will be participating in next weekend's Maker Fair, and we'll have information about that event online at kcur.org later in the day. To listen back to today's show or any of our past conversations, visit us online at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @KCURCST. We'd love to interact with you there. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Chief of Police Daryl Forte. Be sure and tune in for that. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, with lots of help from Matt Hodapp and Christina Leffring. Linda Scher is our announcer and board operator. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date. Next.